Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 27th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
That's great. Great to have you along. And today we're particularly pleased to be joined by Mariah Tinger, who is an author and raconteur and a person who we're happy to have with us. So how you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing very well. Glad to be here.
Good, good, good. So, Mariah, tell me a little bit about yourself. What have you been doing lately?
So I'm a professor. I teach corporate sustainability, but I'm also an author. I wrote a book called Protecting the Planet, Environmental Champions from Conservation to Climate Change with my father, Bud Titlow. And we're very excited. We just recently found out that we won the 2017 Best General Nonfiction Book Award from the Green Book Festival.
Congratulations.
For our book, Protecting the Planet.
That's great. That's great. So tell me, what's in the book? I mean, what's it about? What do people want to know? Why should they be interested in reading it?
So Protecting the Planet is basically about environmental heroes. My father and I studied these heroes from the past and tried to figure out how they made their environmental movement successful, and then also environmental heroes from the present and how they've made, you know, their actions toward really focusing on climate change, and pulled out some of the key characteristics of these leaders and how we can learn from them and apply all of that to climate action and moving forward with success in that realm.
So that raises, I mean, that begs the question, right? Who's your sort of favorite pre-climate change, pre-1960s kind of climate, well, not climate, I mean, conservation, I guess, what's the word? What words were they using back in the day? What were the
motivations? Champions or leaders?
Were those the things they were saying in 1910? How did they describe themselves?
That's a good question. I don't know. I know that one of my favorite stories from the book was Harriet Lawrence Hemingway, who was a prominent and fashionable Boston socialite in the 1890s, and found out that she discovered that birds were being slaughtered, you know, in massive numbers for hats. And as this big Boston socialite, she started to organize all of these ladies' teas and gathered her extensive social network together to protest the purchase of hats with feathers. And eventually she formed the Massachusetts Audubon Society, which obviously is still going very strong. The fashion of hats, yeah.
Really? And so do you think, I mean, from your experience, I mean, that is a, not, I wouldn't say top down, but I mean, clearly the ability or the, I mean, so what was the value that was being violated in her eyes, right? Why did the killing of birds for their feathers, do you know why that so irritated her?
I think she just, she you know, cared about birds. She was interested in their preservation. And I think that when she heard about how massively they were being slaughtered, some to the point of extinction, the point of being a threatened species and endangered. At the time, I don't think they categorized them that way.
I was going to say, I mean, they probably didn't use those words, right?
Right, but she just knew that they were, you know, really slaughtering these birds. And I think that motivated her just on, you know, the intrinsic loss of wildlife that she cared about.
Interesting. The Mass Audubon Society, The Audubon Society, now Audubon, just to go back further, Audubon was a guy who drew pictures of birds, right? That's the original Audubon.
Right, John James Audubon,
John,
exactly.
And so how did she end? Was there already an Audubon Society nationally or something? I mean, that's maybe more history than you have in the book, but do you remember?
Yeah, we covered John James Audubon's actually featured in the book as well. And I'm not 100% positive on this, but I think that the Massachusetts Audubon Society was first. Don't quote me on that.
Uh-huh.
I know that the Massachusetts Audubon Society has continued to it's part of the National Audubon, but it's really well known as its own separate sort of
really?
Entity.
Uh-huh. Was the Audubon guy, he was not a Massachusetts guy, was he? No.
Let's see. I'm trying to think about John James Audubon. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that he traveled a lot. But I do not think he was from Massachusetts.
I mean, I could just imagine if I was set myself in sort of the 1890s and knew that, the birds were being killed for the feathers. I suppose they just, again, now I'm just freelance, free associating, but I suppose in the 1890s, they're probably, within 15 to 20 years of realizing that the buffalo had been exterminated, right? And that there was probably some consciousness, maybe not even particularly spoken, of the potential for the damage of overusing that kind of resource. And I guess the other thing is the value that I imagine would be, if you find a bird beautiful, it's an insult to kill the bird to take, sort of like taking the tusks off an elephant or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny. There was, I think it was Hornaday who I believe he started some of the first, well, he found a bison, an American bison, and actually brought it to Washington, D.C. and
mm-hmm.
had it put, he had it tethered.
You mean live and walked
alive,
it into?
Alive, a live bison. Yeah, he brought a live bison because, they were talking in the sort of D.C. area. I mean, I guess in
mm-hmm.
the country, there was a lot of talk about what was happening to the bison, but not a lot of people were really connecting with it. So he just got this bison and brought it to DC and put it up and used that as sort of a way to inspire people to care about the bison. And it worked. It worked. And I think he went on to sort of start and run zoos. And I don't necessarily agree with with zoos.
Which is a whole question in itself, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, at the time, I think that was a way to expose people to wildlife and to get them to connect with it. And it was effective because it helped in a large degree to save the bison.
Interesting. So tell me, I mean, do you, having looked at all this stuff, is there some through line of continuity from Ms. Hemingway? You should know, this weekend I went to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, so I'm very, very high on Boston, turn-of-century Boston socialites. But, I mean, is there any connecting line from Mrs. Hemingway through to Bill McKibben? I mean, do you see any continuities there? Or has the system, has the consciousness of sort of, I mean, I'll use the modern word, sort of environmental sustainability. Has that changed so much that these people would not know each other?
So as my dad and I were studying all these past environmental heroes and the current sort of climate change activists and heroes, so to speak, there are a couple things that do come through. And one of the big things is sort of singleness of purpose and persistence in these folks. You had Harriet Lawrence Hemingway, who when she decided that this was her cause, it was her cause. I mean, this was what she devoted all of her time and attention and resources to. And you have another example of Howard Zonisser, who...
These people need to be in a pantheon, somehow. In a pantheon, right? They're names that don't ring a bell at all with me. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, so Howard Zonisser, he was the one who drafted the Wilderness Act, and he actually he wrote 66 drafts of it over an 8-year period. I mean, he lived, breathed, and just everything for the Wilderness Act. And he actually died, I think, 6 months before Lyndon B. Johnson signed it into law. But, again, that example of just this persistence and this dedication to the and singleness of purpose. And you see that going all the way through to Bill McKibben, who's, has been quoted as saying this maybe is not exactly how he would have decided to spend his life, but it's a really, it's such an important cause. And, you know, whatever he's given up a lot of things to be he's Bill McKibben, of course, the founder of 350.org.
Right. The man who needs no introduction, right? At least on this show.
Exactly. You know, he's a writer, but has really become this big voice and spokesperson because this is his cause and it's what he cares about. And so you really see this
singleness
focus
of purpose.
Interesting. We saw that a lot all the way across. Another example is James Balog, who is a National Geographic photographer and founder of the Extreme Ice Survey, which is it's pretty much the biggest photographic study of glaciers ever conducted. He had time lapse cameras set up to capture glaciers as they were melting.
So and what year? What years were this? I mean, what time frame?
Oh, recently. Let's see. James Balog is. I don't know if you've heard of the movie Chasing Ice.
Yes.
So James Balog. That's all James Balog's photography. That's the Extreme Ice Survey is. What Chasing Ice is based on, his pictures. So I think he had something like 40 cameras set up all over the world to capture these glaciers as they disappeared. And, you know, of course, some of the pictures he captured are the last pictures we'll ever see of those glaciers because they're gone and they will most likely not be back in our lifetime. But again, you know, Balog's out there and, you know, he's, if you've seen the movie, he had some serious knee problems and all of these other things that he, you know, surgeries he was having. And yet he was still out there climbing, you know, ice picks, ice axes in hand, trying to climb all these ice glaciers. Walls to try and capture these photographs for this movie. Just total dedication, singleness of purpose and persistence really are characteristics you see from, you know, a long time ago all the way to today.
That's interesting. That's good advice for, I suppose, in this despairing day of climate activism, right? You look and say, oh, my God, you have to summon up the intensity to persist, right? The mental, and I suppose, I mean, I think that the, I mean, I sometimes wonder about myself. Is, you know, why I'm obsessed with this issue and why, I mean, I don't know what you guys think. I'm sure you think about climate issues a lot. It's not something that you can walk away from. And the question is how, I mean, the persistence of intention is a good thing to have. I mean, it's not something you should feel bad about at all, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really true. You know, you picture this guy, for example, Howard Zonister, banging his head. He must have felt like he was just banging his head against a wall trying to get this Draft of the Wilderness Act pushed through. And he didn't give up. And, you know, he did. He didn't get to see it. But, you know, thanks to him. And, of course, another reason why now is more than ever we need people to be persistent and have that singleness of purpose. Because a lot of these things that the people we studied and worked for, the people who that we studied worked for, such as the Wilderness Act, are actually now under threat right now. We're at risk of losing a lot of these.
And I guess it's an interesting lesson how much effort it takes to build these things and how easy it is to destroy them and how they require our active defense, right? And it's just interesting.
Right, it goes back to democracy and sticky, you know, being vocal about what you believe in and what's important to you. And
I guess, I mean, so one last question. I mean, do you have any sense of the people that you studied? Their passion for their particular, I don't know, again, over 100 years, what the right word is, their particular environmental focus, was that a choice? Or do you think that that was in them from the beginning and they were just somehow expressing it? I mean, because what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination. I think some were sort of, well, I guess there must be. It's a really good question. There must be. You know, I think a lot of them must have this drive for nature that, or not just nature, but you know, the commons, clean air, clean water, that drove them to protect it. You know, against all odds, you think of Rachel Carson, who She didn't, it's not like it really helped her career to be fighting against DDT. It was just something that
she felt compelled to do.
It just felt right. It felt right to her.
I mean, I know David Suzuki, I think it's David Suzuki, talks about biophilia, right? I think, I mean, I don't know if he invented the term or not, but it's sort of the, you know, the love of the world, right? And how, you know, how some people may carry more of that than others, right? Or be just naturally inclined that way, that they just can't not do something.
Right. Yeah, I think E.O. Wilson as well as a big biophilia person.
So, well, so tell me again, Mariah, what's the name of the name of the book?
It is Protecting the Planet, Environmental Champions from Conservation to Climate Change. And it's available. It's it was published by Prometheus Books, and it's available on Amazon as well as the Random House
Cool. And is
website.
There a website or anything that you do you have a dedicated website for the book, or is it?
Yeah, I do. I have it's www.protectingtheplanet.earth.
As opposed to protectingtheplanet.mars and protectingtheplanet.venus.
Right. Well, I think protectingtheplanet.com wasn't available, so I went with Earth. Seemed fitting.
Well, good for you. Well, that's great. Thank you. That's very interesting. It sounds like a great book and a fascinating topic to have studied. So thanks for discussing that with us.
Thanks for having me.
What I'll do is we'll put up some links to some of those things, in particular to the website, Mariah's website, book website, and stuff like that. And that'll be at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook, of course, at mass/massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your favorite smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many podcast directories. If there's a podcast directory that we're not on, please let us know. So we'll close to where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thank you, DR, for being here.
Thanks.
And Mariah, thank you so much for coming in to chat about everything. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Stay cool.
Okay. Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.